From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And, you know, we do that through sharing stories. And today we have a story that I think is unique to the Sacramento region. We have a young man who is making movies here in our region. And, you know, we're not known in Sacramento as the, you know, filmmaking capital of the world, but Zach Hirsch has figured out a way to make Sacramento a great place to, I guess, drive an entrepreneurial business associated with movie making. So welcome to the show, Zach. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me. Really
you bet. So you went to, did you go to Placer High School up in Auburn?
I did.
Okay, so you're a local guy. And when did you realize you were a filmmaker?
probably from like elementary school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had a friend who I grew up with, Tanner, and him and I every day after school would make like short films and commercials and little like horror movies with his like mom's VHS camera, and that just kind of sparked it in me how fun it was to make movies, and yeah, just carried with me throughout my life until, you know, this point where I'm actually getting to do it for real.
Yeah. So now, how many movies have you made so far?
I've made three legitimate feature films and then two like indie college films. So I guess five features total.
And then maybe walk me through this progression. So indie college, it's an independent. I don't really even know what that is, actually. Yeah. Indie, I'm guessing it's like, stands for independent.
Yeah, it's the college indie is when it's like you put together all the money you have in your pocket and you kind of bootstrap the whole thing and recruit anyone who's willing to be a part of it. And so in college, I met my now producing partner, James Rich. And that's where it all kind of got going, where we would write scripts and then just go out and make them. And it was cool. We went to Sonoma State and they had a lot of like little film festivals that they would put on. So you would have like 2 weeks or something to make a film and then they would have a competition for it. So that was essentially, because both of us didn't go to film school per se at that point. And so that was kind of like our film school, just doing it, you know, boots on the ground.
And those kind of films, do you make money with them? Do you sell them? Or is it just for like to win a contest and impress the chicks?
At the time, you think you're going to win Sundance, but yeah. I think that's the first thing you learn as a indie filmmaker, that you're probably not going to get into Sundance with those.
Yeah, so I think we've all heard of Sundance Film Festival. I've never been. Have you been there before?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so that's where people go, and it's like a film festival. And if you make it and get recognized there, then your film might have some value at that point. Is that right?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's a you know, huge festival to get into, and yeah, I think we have four rejection letters from them now. So.
That's awesome. Yeah. Or not awesome. That's an interesting story. That, you know, because an entrepreneurship, right? You're a filmmaker. There's a lot of artistic stuff associated with making a film, obviously super artistic. There's a little bit of that when you're making trying to create a business as well. It's not all science. There's a lot of art associated. So I want to talk a little bit about that, but maybe just walk me through the journey. So you did these two films, and then you got into one of the first of the three full-length motion pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, walk me through that.
So kind of whole story getting to where I am now is I studied marketing with a theater minor at Sonoma State, and then once I graduated, I kind of took like a year hiatus, and then after that hiatus, I thought I could like apply to all of the, you know, the big LA like CAAs and Warner Brothers and get like a job and then, you know, just green light my career. And, you know, I ended up with like 60 rejection emails.
More rejection, jeez.
Yeah. Film is it's a career of rejection. So yeah, you have to have thick skin. But I ended up moving down to LA anyways, and then did kind of like a hybrid approach where I took night classes at UCLA. They had like a producing writing program, and then during the day was just working at a gym. So it was a long struggle through that kind of like 2 year period. And then my like very final class at UCLA, I got hooked up with an internship at an international sales company for movies. So we were taking movies that had been released in the US and then selling them in like Japan and you know, Germany and all over the country. And through that, I learned what was, you know, what you can kind of make for not a ton of money and it would still have a domestic and international appeal. And that was horror films. So that's kind of where the, you know, the seed was planted for the first film that I ended up making, which was Follower. So kind of my whole time working at that sales agency, I was texting my partner, Jimmy, and saying, you know, I really think we should make a horror movie because we can make it for, you know, not a ton of money. You don't need famous actors. And most likely, if we do a pretty good job, it'll get a distribution deal.
All right. So I'm going to dive into this just a little bit for to educate our audience a little bit, because I think this might cross over to other people that are, you know, I've got the big dream and then, you know, going and learning the business hands-on versus like just studying in college. How important is it to go get that, I guess, real world experience versus like what you might read out of a textbook or listen to from a professor?
It's massive. It's funny, at every stage of this, I've thought I've like known everything, you know, that the quintessential thing where it's like, we make our first movie and I'm like, okay, this is how movies are made. It's, you know, I got it down now. And then we make a slightly bigger movie and I'm like, oh my God, I didn't know all that stuff. And then you go through like, an even bigger movie. So it keeps going and going and going. And yeah, at a certain point it transcends textbooks. Like you have to have the, I always like that saying where it's like, you have to know the rules to break them kind of thing. But it kind of applies where it's like, you have to know in order to like transcend. So like in film classes, you know, they teach you the basics of like budgeting and yada, 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 but they don't teach you negotiating with someone's manager, which is a totally different, you know, so it's like you have the basics and then you apply the, you essentially like the real world, you just kind of have to go out and you like do it. There's nothing else really to, you know, you just learn as you go.
Well, thinking about managing risk, because we know that making a movie, you can make what you think is a great movie and then it bombs at the box office. But there are ways to, let's call it, hedge your bet a little bit. There's now all these other distribution channels beyond, you know, going to the movie theater, going to the box office. How important are, I'll call it hedging your bet, or the business model associated with it, especially when you're doing it on maybe more of a limited budget?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting in the film industry. It's like, it doesn't work until it works is kind of the motto, where no one really knows what's going to be successful until it's successful. But you can hedge your bets with things such as genre, like kind of what I was saying with the horror genre. And like action films is another way to kind of hedge your bet. And because if you have a, you know, a very low budget with not a lot of cast, and this is kind of from the sales world, but if you make like a coming of age drama, it's probably not gonna sell that well just because it doesn't have the buzz of like the horror dynamic or action. And so there's like micro things you could do on the smaller scale, like to hedge your bets. And then there's also, you know, once you get bigger and bigger budgets, the biggest way to hedge your bet is with cast. So, you know, that's why someone like Brad Pitt has a ton of value and gets these huge paychecks, because, you know, if you put him in your movie, there's an actual like sheet you could see of how much value he has internationally and domestically. So you can, I mean, there's always a chance that it bombs, but you'll at least be able to be like, okay, at minimum, we'll probably be able to recoup this amount.
Okay.
And you know, getting deeper in the wood into the weeds of it, there's also pre-sales. So you can, if you have a really good package put together, sell to distributors before the movie's even made. And then the whole name of the game is just delivering it to them. But
so it's de-risked at that point because you've already got basically a contract at some level.
Yeah. But you still have to make the thing, which is
easy task. Execute, which is not easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So first, what's the first movie then? It's a horror movie?
Yeah. So the first one is a horror movie called Follower. And that one, we were really trying to play with the traditional slasher genre. So kind of like the, you know, the teens in the woods and then the guy chases them with the knife, that like traditional trope is what we were kind of wanting to morph into the like modern dynamic, in which we thought it would be very interesting if it was a social media influencer posting her like everyday life, and then the killer was using that to stalk her. So, you know, she's essentially giving away like her location and so on and so forth. So that was the
premise.
That's
kind of a current, you know, seems pretty realistic in terms of somebody wanting to go after somebody that's a probably super attractive, hot influencer. Yeah. And so you're going to go out. And so is there a lot of, I guess, blood and guts in these type of movies? I mean, do you have to demonstrate all that stuff, or are you tone that down? Are these R-rated or what?
There's like kind of like the formula you're saying is within each genre, there's formulas that you kind of have to hit certain beats on. So by like X number of minutes, it's good to have someone like die if it's a horror movie, or if it's an action movie, you have this much action by this point. So we really tried to, with like the creation of the movie, hit those beats. It's not super over the top with gore. It's more of like a thriller type.
You're such a clean cut, nice guy. It's like hard to picture you making a horror movie or any movie when somebody gets killed. You're such a nice guy.
Yeah, it's
that's not your personality.
Yeah, it's like what my partner and I always talk about is it's like it's art. So you know, it's a form of expression, and it's not necessarily like, you know, indicative of who we are, but it's just an expression. And what I like with horror is you're really taking something to like the nth degree of where it could go, because you're kind of playing and then. So it's like, okay, you got these girls and they're posting their life, and then this guy's following them, and then it, you know, they lose service or so it's
right.
You know, I like to, like, we take it kind of light. You know, it's we're playing, and it's supposed to be fun, and the audience is supposed to, you know, have a like a fun reaction to
it. Yeah, some horror movies are funny, and others scare the crap out of you, right?
Yeah.
And it's, oh God, I can't sleep tonight. Is yours got more of the humorous side to it?
I think it has a good mixture of both, where it is a thriller, it is scary at times, but there is some like more lighthearted moments.
Okay, so that was your first one, Follower.
Yeah,
and how did that do? Were you happy with the?
Yeah, it for the budget that we had, and like the cast range and all of that, it really exceeded expectations. So
was there any cast members we may have heard of before?
Not really in that one.
Okay,
but yeah, it ended up getting a distribution deal without playing in any film festivals, which was a pretty big deal. And really with that one, it was more of a proof of concept, because I had kind of like left the nest of that sales agency I was at, and I was really trying to see if I could actually, you know, call a distributor and get a deal with them on my own with a movie that we made on our own.
And you need a distributor. You can't go direct to, I don't know, some movie theater chain and bypass a distributor.
You can, but it's very expensive. You have to do everything yourselves marketing wise. And you just limit kind of like the exposure that you'll get, unless you're coming into it with like a huge audience behind you already. Okay. Yeah, there's like those Fathom events where you can do a theatrical release on your own, stuff like that. But I think generally when you're starting out and if you don't have a huge, you know, overhead that you're trying to recoup on the film, it's good just to get the experience of working with a real distributor and going through that process.
So the distributor, do they also take care of taking it to streaming and other sort of avenues?
Yeah.
Not just the box office?
No. So they essentially take the movie from you and then create the release strategy for it. So it'll go to iTunes, Amazon. There's now basically three different release windows. It's ones like streaming, and then transactional, and then ad. So streaming is like Netflix or Hulu, where you're paying for a subscription and you just get to watch it. Transactional is where you're like going to iTunes and you pay 99 cents or, you know, $2 to watch it. And then the new thing is like Tubi is ad based. So you get paid as people are watching and the ads are playing.
Okay.
During the movie.
Yeah. And which, right now, which is, tip for that one, maybe you could speak to that one. Which one drives the most, you know, gross profit?
So it's now on the third phase of release. So it went through transactional, where it was on iTunes and Amazon. It was cool. We got like, I think at one point we were like 10 on the horror charts on iTunes. And then it ended up selling to Tubi through our distributors. So they handle all that. So it's been on Tubi, and that's been really great. So the most money has come from Tubi, I think, because there's no barrier to entry. Like when someone's going to spend, you know, $6 on a movie and they're looking at your independent horror movie and then Top Gun's next to it, like you're fighting the big dogs and you have to win their money when there, if there's not like, you know, like I'm saying, like a cast member or something, it's hard to win that battle.
I've heard. Okay. So I used to own a bunch of video stores and certain locations around there were 12 stores in Sacramento, and like our South Sac store, they love the horror and the chop 'em up and the, you know, the action stuff. And, you know, if they had a picture of somebody, you know, with a gun on the outside, South Sac, they like those movies, right?
Yeah.
You know, you go to, let's say, someplace like Auburn, and they might like the love story a little bit more. And so I wonder on that front, is the international audience, because now you can distribute this stuff internationally, especially on streaming. Mm-hmm. Does the international audience appreciate the killing and the and all that more than the American audience?
Yes.
I assume that. Yeah, not that South Sac is like, you know, the international audience, but that's how it was for us. It was crazy.
There's still a huge DVD market in Japan for horror movies.
DVD.
Yeah. They love, like, there's still big DVD stores there. And when I was selling movies, that was like a big thing. Like you'd sell to them and then they'd release on DVD. That's the thing with horror and why we started in horror is it just transcends, like, you know, location. And I think a big reason is, regardless of language barrier. So if you think about a comedy, like comedy here is like funny to us, but in Japan, it might not make a lot of sense. Whereas we all are kind of universally scared of the same things. Like guys chasing you with a knife is scary if you're in Germany or
even
Japan.
Even if it's subtitles or whatever, like that's scary.
Yeah. And with horror, like dialogue isn't extremely important. So you kind of get that gap bridged a little bit as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So what's the second movie?
So the second movie is called Followers.
Oh, I thought Followers was the last one.
No, so this is a common thing that keeps happening. So Follower is number one, and then Followers with an S is number two.
Oh, was it like a sequel?
So we called it a requel. It's like an old term from the 80s where when you get a bit more money and you go back and kind of like beef up a story, was essentially what we did. So it's in a sense a combination of the first story with a more expanded second story. So we see the girls 18 months later after the attack, and there's flashbacks to what happened to them in Follower One. And it essentially just made like the full story.
I have to imagine that one, there's, let's say, cost benefit associated with using some of the old footage and that kind of thing. So you can recreate that, have a new release at a, let's call it a fraction of the cost or some kind of reduced price.
Yeah, yeah. And a big thing with that on the business end was us making sure we had, it's called like clip rights, so that we could pull from the first one and like safely without getting sued, put it into the second one. So yeah, we kind of framed it in the second one as a documentary. So it's a documentary was made about what happened to the girls in the first attack. And then the second one starts where that documentary is coming out, and it incites the group of villains to go after them again, essentially.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I don't know if you and I talked about this before, but what's that? You know movies really well. I can't think. I'm getting old. I can't remember the names of these movies and TV shows and stuff like that. There was a TV show out that it didn't really. It was about the making of The Godfather. Do you remember seeing it? What did, I can't really think of
The Offer.
Oh, The Offer. Yeah, great. I watched that start to finish, but it was a little bit of kind of a documentary, although it wasn't a documentary, but it kind of showed how it might have gone to make The Godfather. That was great. And I have to imagine these, I guess, movies about movies or TV shows about movies find, you know, because a movie is, you know, that's an interesting, you know, story.
Yeah.
The making of a movie.
Yeah. Well, something my partner and I always joke about, because we watched that show together, and a lot of the times they build in this really misleading dynamic for people like think that you know, going into the film industry where Al Reddy, who like ends up producing The Godfather, sneaks onto the Paramount lot and then just chases after the president of the studio.
Oh yeah.
And you know, he like corners him at his car and he's like, oh, you got ambition, kid. I'm going to let you produce the next three movies for Paramount. And it's like, in reality, you probably like get probably arrested if you go on the Paramount lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's great to see a little bit of a window into just how crazy it is to like make a movie, which I do think that show really conveyed.
Yeah. So you have one movie that's coming out like right now. Is that Followers?
Yeah. So, okay. So Followers was released I think like 3 weeks ago now.
Okay.
And yeah, it's doing great. It's it went on a streaming service called Screambox, which is just kind of just like Netflix, but for horror.
Okay.
It's been sitting top five there, which has been awesome. We got some press in the New York Times, which is really cool. And now it's being pitched to different, more like higher tier, streaming services like Hulu and so on. So okay. Yeah, it's kind of doing everything we hoped it would do.
And that these two will pay like for the, I mean, these will be on, some recurring revenue for you for, I guess, indefinitely. I mean, they're always going to have a spot. They're always going to have some income.
Yeah, that's the goal, you know. So essentially, most of these distribution deals in the U.S. are about 7 years. So they'll kind of see that it goes, because it benefits them too, you know, if it's making money. So it'll go from service to service for that amount of time, and the rights will expire. So you'll get, so like our Tubi deal for Follower will expire in September, and then it'll get relicensed to another. So it's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving.
I think I told you that I invested into a movie. It was Vietnam related, but it was sort of like a G-rated Vietnam movie. And it did, they released it at the box office and it did good for one weekend at like one box office because they really promoted it. But then after that, it went straight to streaming and it paid residuals. We lost money on it. So it was a loser from an investment standpoint. But yeah, they still get a, you know, I think you get $10 every so often or whatever. They still get something.
Yeah. And the thing, you know, if you're in Hollywood, everyone talks about like getting money from distributors is always the quest because you kind of have to hunt them down. And we've been really fortunate with the two we worked with one company called Freestyle for Follower and then Cineverse for Followers. And they've been really great with paying on time and everything.
Oh, okay.
So that's a big thing to look into for people who are making movies and getting distribution deals is doing your due diligence that they will pay you.
Yeah. So do they pay, and maybe every contract looks different, but is it typically where there's like a base fee and then you get a percentage or something like that?
Yeah. So if you're really lucky, you get what's called a minimum guarantee. Mm-hmm. So they'll do some sort of hedge on, you know, the release of the film. So you get like 10 grand, or if it's a really big movie, it could be like millions. Based on the budget sort of situation. And then from there, it's all the deals I've done have been either quarterly or quarterly plus like 60 or 90 days, you'll get paid and a report of how it's doing on the different platforms.
Okay. And maybe don't get into your specifics, but like what's the industry standard? Is there a percentage that's kind of the industry standard, or is it like all over the board in terms of how that goes?
Do you mean in terms of like revenue?
In terms of the split.
It's either like 70, 30.
70, 30 goes 60. To the, 30 goes to the distribution yeah. company, 70. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the most of it still goes to the filmmaker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then the third movie, that's the one you and I first started talking about, right? You are an athlete. You do CrossFit and your dad and I met at yoga and he's a super successful business guy and we kind of hit it off. And then I met you through him. And we started talking about this other movie that I think is really interesting and it's probably a pretty big departure from the first four. And maybe tell us about, is it okay to talk about that one yet?
Oh, yeah,
it's not released yet. It's coming out.
We can talk as much as.
Okay. Yeah. You're working on this one and it was really intriguing to me because, maybe I'll have you describe it. And so the way you described it to me was intriguing. So I'll let you describe it.
Yeah. So it was essentially my dream project. It was a story that I wrote as a short, kind of like a short story a long time ago. And it's kind of just been one of those things that, you know, sits in your mind. And I was like, when I get to the point that I can make this thing, I'm going to make this thing. And it is it's a pretty big pivot from the genre and world I was in with the horror movies. And so this one is a, it's essentially a faith-based survival story, where a couple get into a rafting accident on the American River and are forced to survive. So it kind of morphed into our biggest budget project and our biggest crew and our biggest cast with actual, you know, names within the faith world. So it was a very transcendent process.
So when we watched that movie, if we've seen other movies, I think most of us have seen, I'm trying to think of like, I want to say giant, what are other movies? I've seen The Chosen. Mm-hmm. What else in terms of like, might be like it in terms of, you say faith-based, I don't even know exactly what that means or the best way to describe that to our audience.
Yeah, well, so in terms of like the story dynamic, I think a really good reference is the River Wild movie.
Yeah. So, was that Kevin Bacon? Who was in that?
I think it's, I want to say Kevin Bacon and Meryl Streep.
Yeah, Kevin Bacon plays a bad guy, I think, in that one. You're like, Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, and then they just remade it, and there's a new one on Netflix.
I hadn't seen that.
It's another River Wild. So they just did the same, but it's a kind of different plot. So it has that level of intensity with the...
That movie was super intense.
Yeah, we went to town with the rafting dynamic of this movie, so...
Okay, on the American River in the rapids, and so you have danger associated with just being on the water.
Yeah, real, and everything's real. Like, there's all the stunts were real. We actually flipped the raft. We went through all the rapids. We had water cameras and the whole, like, 9 yards, which was it was our first time doing legitimate stunts, which was... It was exhilarating just sitting there and watching.
There's some real danger when you're doing that stuff too. I mean, people get hurt, you know, when they aren't doing stunts in the American River, just trying to safely navigate down the river.
Yeah.
And you filmed it like in one of those years where we had a lot of rain last year. So I heard don't go rafting. I was going to go on a rafting trip and I'm not a rafter, but I was going to go on a trip and they're like, not this year, dude, don't do it.
Yeah.
So you filmed it in that year.
Yeah. It was funny. Cause there's like a line in the movie where the character says like, don't go out in the river cause the snow melts high. And then, you know, and then made the, so, and then it actually happened in reality, which was funny. So yeah, the river was raging and, What we ended up doing was working with the Lindgren brothers, Scott and Dustin, who are locals. Scott is like a world-renowned kayaker. I think the River Runner is a documentary about him. And so we worked primarily with Dustin to coordinate everything because he's like a rafting expert. And what we did was hired professional river raft guides from the American River and then just use them as stunt doubles. So we matched how the kind of like the look of the characters. And then we put our real actors in like a calm part of the river. And then when it got to the rapids, we swapped them out and then they went through and flipped, they had to flip like, I think it ended up being like 4 or 5 times.
Oh my gosh. So you got to get all dried off after you flip, right? Cause you weren't drenched before
I was safely on the cliff with the cameraman.
But your people in the raft, they like had to do it over and over.
Yeah.
Getting water up their nose.
They were troopers.
All that.
Yeah. These raft guides in the American River Canyon are like the best in the world. Mm-hmm. So getting to work with them was quite a crazy experience.
Okay. So faith-based, you mentioned River Wild. That's not faith-based. I don't know. Maybe the new one is, but, I mentioned The Chosen. I've seen some of these other movies that you can kind of tell are faith-based because they've got a really, there's no F-bombs. There's not a lot of, you know, foul language and stuff, but they still make them as realistic as they can so that it feels, you know, it doesn't feel like you're setting it up to drive home a message necessarily. Mm-hmm. Is that how this is?
Yeah. What we wanted to do, and not knocking the traditional like faith genre at all, but we wanted to kind of up the intensity in the space where we both kind of come from this, you know, making thriller film backgrounds and like a lot of intensity and, you know, high drama and stuff like that, where it kind of seemed in studying the genre that a lot of them were more just kind of on the nose dramas where it's, you know, not a lot of actions taking place and so on. And we wanted to make something that was really like intense and gritty and, you know, survival driven, where they're in this gnarly accident and it's a couple who are dealing with, you know, struggling with their faith going into it. And then how does that carry through being stranded on an island with your, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, with your significant other in a very bad place.
Was there a bad guy in it? Like the River Wild? Can you say?
There is essentially an antagonist, but I like to think of like the elements as the real bad guy in this, where like the river is the one that gets them and having to survive. But there is a main antagonist who kind of gets them into the mess in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I know you probably can't tell too much about it. Makes me want to say what happened, you know, but yeah. I don't want to prompt you to give it away unnecessarily. Okay, so what else can you tell us about that movie then that maybe I didn't ask?
Yeah, so I like post-production wise, we ended up linking up with Kappa Studios, who is the, they do all the like the post-editing for the Chosen TV series. Mm. So they're extremely like as high-end as it gets in terms of the faith world, and right now the Chosen's the biggest show kind of out there.
Absolutely.
So they took over the edit essentially at this point. And so they did the assembly edit, and now we're working with them on the sound edit and the color. And so it's turning out to be an insanely good product.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen The Chosen, that's a story of Jesus, mm-hmm. and it's intriguing. It's like a, you know, it's kind of like a mini series, I guess, if you will. I don't know how many episodes there are, but it lasts for a while. And it's a story of his life, but it's done in a way that, I don't know, kind of seems realistic, because, you know, they're speaking English and they're talking like regular people at some level. But it still tells the story of what happened with Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they try to like follow the Bible as close as you can within like a dramatic narrative in terms of them like acting. Obviously they're adding some dialogue and stuff, cause it's not just 100%, you know, what's said in the Bible. But I do think it's a really cool show that kind of humanizes the whole story. That's where, you know, you don't want to go in and thinking it's like a biblical scholar documentary, but it is something where it's this, you know, covers the story, humanizes everything. And I really enjoyed it, before I even knew I would work with them. So yeah, it was cool being a fan of the show and then being connected with the people.
So now you have like the best in that genre editing, right? Doing all the editing and making it look good. All the shots that you guys got and all the audio that you got and that kind of thing. And they probably have to add sound effects and stuff.
So post-production wise, so there's I think like essentially the main things is you have the assembly edit, so you put the whole movie, when you finish filming you just have like a stockpile of footage, and then you got to piece it all together. So they helped us doing that in making like the edit, and then it goes through sound editing, so it sounds pretty terrible when you have it fresh out of the camera and the mics and stuff. So they have to blend everything and add sound effects, and there's called like Foley, where, you know, if someone sets a cup down, you have to kind of imitate that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It seems like such a disjointed process. Like, why doesn't the mic just get the, but when you're actually doing it, like it does stuff like interrupts dialogue and things like that. So the main goal is capturing dialogue, and then they add all the sounds. And then, it goes through a process called color grading, where when it comes out of the camera raw, it's very gray. And so they'll add like a color to it, and then you do your score and your VFX. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into the kind of the second half of after you've shot the thing.
Obviously, they're the best, I guess, in the industry, or one of the best. But do you still have creative input during that process? Like, no, I don't want that color, or when they set that cup down, it's a little bit too loud.
Totally. It's a partnership. So we trusted them to kind of give them the assembly edit, and then we sat in the studio with them after they've had it. I think they had it for about 2 months, and then we got to sit in the room with them for a week and be like, you know, we really liked it better this way and this, and then also trusting that they know the genre and in certain elements where we were like, you know, kind of butting heads over, just on like our own internal team. So it was nice having like a third party that really knew the genre and was able to just, you know, I was, the edit that they put together, you know, so much as the producer and the writers and like you put so much of your heart and soul into this thing and it's so much work. And then you hand it off to someone and it's really one of the most important things is the edit. Cause that's what the audience, like no one, when you're sitting in the theater, you don't care about like how much the producer struggled when they were in production, you know, you just kind of care about what you're seeing. And so that's what they put together. And I was like 10 out of 10 happy with it.
Well, I always feel like that's how one of the biggest things that we have to do in our lives as entrepreneurs or just anybody that wants to be successful is what are you going to edit? Like, what are you going to cut? Because you're in love with the whole thing.
Yeah.
You got to cut so that you have the best stuff pop, right? You're only working on the cool stuff if you're an entrepreneur or the most impactful stuff if you're trying to build a great life. But making a movie, I have to imagine, is a little bit like that. Man, you got to have great editing.
Yeah.
Saying no.
Yeah. And you have to have people that are willing to confront you. Cause like, I think that's so true. And it's such a good point where like I wrote the first draft of the script and it was like 200 pages and I was so in love with it. You know, I was like, this is the best thing ever. And then my partner, Jimmy, read it and he was like, there's no way you could have like, I think the first dynamic was they were stranded on the beach for like, I think like it was like 60 days or something. And he was like, how are we like, you can't, it's not possible. And so we got in like a month long argument going back and forth and I'd be like, all right, we'll just do 30 days. And then I would rewrite the script and then it'd be like, no, that doesn't, still doesn't work. And so it eventually, it's funny that, and this is one of the things you kind of see, like looking back, is the story ends up now being that she's out there for 3 days and it works. And then when you know, you're shooting it, you're like, okay, I was totally wrong. And I'm glad there's people who are able to speak into the story.
That's about teamwork. Yeah. To be able to come to a consensus, if you will, on something, you know, that differentiated, you know, 3 days from whatever, 60. Okay. So now on this movie, maybe walk me through the vision for this. You have distribution for this. Is this different than the others?
Yeah. So this one is a bit different in terms of the scale of it. We're hoping to play this one in theaters, which is not something we've gotten to do so far. So our big goal once post-production is done is to push for a theatrical distribution deal. Be it, you know, like a limited theatrical release. We just want to see it in, you know, a theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hopefully it gets a lot of screens throughout the country is our main goal. But that's essentially what we're pursuing for this one, is a much bigger distribution situation.
Nice, nice. Okay, yeah. So a couple more questions, just so we don't take all day here. So you're working on three different things. You got to divide your time now. And I can picture entrepreneurs out there thinking, yeah, I can relate to having multiple priorities. You know, you've got your first couple movies. You still got to continue to make those work, but you're working on a new one. Do you have other stuff in the pipeline? How do you line up the opportunities?
Yeah. And I think it's a really good note for entrepreneurs is, if you're going to make something and put it out in the world, you're going to live with it for a really long time. That's a big thing I learned with Follower One is it's not just like, it's not going to be a year. It's going to be a very, like, so if before going into making these things, even if it was like an app or a website or, you know, some delivery service or something, you have to really like think, you know, I'm excited about it now. And when you first have the idea for a thing, it's really exciting. But then am I going to be excited about this in 10 years? Because it's true. Like you're, first and foremost, you have like a big responsibility to your investors, like people who put in the money to not just give up on something and see it through for however long that takes. And with movies, they kind of have a lifetime shelf life, so to speak. The first thing when I was a sales intern was I was selling what was called library titles. So movies that were like, you know, 15 years old or something, and they're still being recycled and resold and the producers are still calling and checking in on, you know, has this movie made any money? So yeah, I think that's an important note for, you know, anything you make is just make sure it's something you want to be a part of for the next, you know, 10 plus
that
years.
Definitely
of your life.
Sounds like entrepreneurship, but it also reminds me of our video stores a little bit, because, you know, a new release comes out, everybody clamors in. And back in those days, you know, you buy 10 copies of something, it's popular, you run out, you've got to convince them to buy some of your, you know, dead stock, if you will. Like, yeah. Hey, there's an action one that used to be really popular. It's a sleeper. So we're always, and you know, you can keep renting those 20 years later, right? They still have value. People will watch old movies or watch movies that, you know, they weren't coming in expecting to, you know, to buy or to rent. But in terms of, you're getting this one off the ground, you've got stuff in the pipeline. Can you give us maybe a little perspective as to, this is turning into a business for you. So is this going to be like, to make one a year? Is this, you know, do you expand upon this?
Yeah. So, our goal as a production company was always, and it's kind of like a natural thing with companies that are surviving in Hollywood, is you want a movie in development, a movie in post-production, and like a movie released, kind of like going at all times. So it's a cycle. So we finally hit the first cycle where we have a released, you know, movie. We had a movie that was coming out, but now it's out. And then we have a movie in post-production. So that those are kind of, it's our first like trifecta, which is really cool to have the cycle start to go. So right now for us, it's kind of, every day there's maintenance to do with Follower One. And now that Followers is out there, there's, you know, like doing podcasts and marketing and meeting with the distributor. And now we just signed with an international sales agent on Followers. So it's going to be like presented at the Cannes Film Festival to like sell there. And so now we'll have to oversee that. And then you're overseeing, you know, international, making sure these international guys are paying you and that it's, you know, that the DVDs are coming out in Japan. And then with the newest movie is called tentatively Confluence. And we're overseeing the post-production of that, which is a very intense, like,
by the way, Confluence, there's an area of the American River called the Confluence. Is that where it's the action takes place?
Yes. But, and also the meaning is like where all the rivers kind of merge together. So we thought that was cool with the plot of the movie where everything's merging together. Yeah. That's taking up a ton of our kind of mental space right now. And then we are writing what will be like our next movie.
Keeping it rolling. Yeah. It's a business. Yeah. Is Sacramento, I guess this is one of my last questions, is like, if Sacramento is not known for making movies, is that changing? Are you a one-off? How does, what's your perspective on Sacramento as a place to make movies?
Yeah. And this is actually a big reason I wanted to talk to you, because it's like, you know, local Sacramento entrepreneurship. And I do think that the film scene in Sacramento is often overlooked in terms of like powerful and the talent level. But 99% of the crew we brought on for this, the movie Confluence, was all Sacramento based and top notch, like as good as people you can work with in Hollywood or, you know, anywhere else in New York. And so I think that, you know, it's all here. The people are here. We worked a lot with the Placer County Film Commission's office, and they were like top notch with helping us get permits that had never been issued before to, you know, film in these like crazy parts of the river. And they worked with us like hand in hand from the day that I had a script. We like went in their office and we were like, how do we shoot this thing here? And they helped us get, you know, we rented space at Sierra College to film scenes, and Jessup University, and throughout Auburn. And the movie wouldn't exist without the Placer County Film Commission's office helping us. And they're very eager and, you know, like willing to work with you. Whereas in not like knocking LA, but there's so much production going on there that you're like, when you reach out to their commission, it's a little bit different story. But I think that's as cool. You know, filmmaker, especially if you're from this area, you don't have to think that, oh, I have to go to LA to make my movie. You can make it here. And there's also like a great array of locations. Like you have, you know, all the way up in Tahoe, you can have that dynamic. You can have the canyon. And then there's the city of Sacramento, which is...
Yeah. I saw him making a movie in downtown Auburn the other day on my way to yoga, too. It's like, there's stuff going... And there's stuff in downtown.
Yeah, and they just did a Paul Thomas Anderson movie just shot in Sacramento with, like, Leonardo DiCaprio. So I think it's, you know, it's growing.
It's coming.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that one of my objectives, I think, with, you know, with our show and some of our platform, the Growth Factory stuff that I work on, is to bring the creators and the creator economy to merge with this tech economy. We got all this innovation and creativity and risk taking, and it's very, very similar. And so to bring those groups together to merge at some level, it's so that they can, I don't know, provide synergy to one another, because it's a lot of the same type of attitudes going into a startup as going into, you know, a filmmaker. Yeah. So to me, we should all be working together.
Yeah. Well, and now the worlds are literally merging with, you know, you have real-time green screens, but it's all tech-driven, and AI is, you can't overlook what's going to happen with that in the next years with Sora and all that stuff, where you know, text to video. And so that's where my mind's at as a filmmaker, is how do I start like working with these tech guys to,
yeah.
And I think a big thing for, you know, more independent type films is, at least in the beginning of all this, you'll be able to add X to your budget without paying for it, so to speak, whereas VFX used to be a tremendous expense. Now you can kind of, you know, integrate these programs and work with these tech guys to expand the scope of the film, is what I'm hoping for until it ultimately replaces us.
Well, congratulations on your success, and I think we are impressed with, I guess, your risk taking. You basically, you know, putting yourself, your reputation on the line, your money on the line, and you're making it work. So congratulations on that, Zach.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me on here and doing so much to promote Sacramento and entrepreneurs in this area.
You betcha.
Yeah.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.